Welcome to the 2013 Community Voices Special. I'm Sarah Buckingham. This hour, we'll hear stories produced in WYSO's 2013 Community Voices training course. We'll go on a bear hunt, uncover a hidden gem in Springfield, meet a local choir singing for social change, and learn why this sound makes some people's brains tingle. 55 years ago, WYSO started as a student-run station at Antioch College. WYSO has always been a training ground, and that tradition continues to this day. WYSO's Community Voices training takes place once a year from January through June. And over those 6 months, people learn to record and edit audio, conduct interviews, write for radio, and produce a feature story. The stories you're about to hear, produced in this year's training, are people's first forays into radio. We train about a dozen people in each course, people from all over the Miami Valley. This year's group includes college professors, print journalists, a landscaper, a blogger, and a college student. The course starts with a vox pop, a short piece made from man-on-the-street interviews. Our trainees head out with portable recording gear and ask people a question at random. They edit those responses together into a vox pop. It's a chance to practice with the gear, approach strangers, get a little experience editing sound. And these non-scientific surveys sometimes yield surprising results. Here's one from Renee Wild.
Okay, a woman walks into a bar, asks 23 random strangers, what advice would you give to your 18-year-old self? And every single person answered the same way.
If I knew what I knew now,
don't get married.
Don't get married at 21.
Think twice before I got married.
Yeah, and that was a disaster.
Don't fall in love with anyone.
Because it's a waste of time.
Maybe not so much a waste of time as a waste of your youth?
Yeah.
Take a little more time before you think you're going to fall in love.
When you're 21, you think you know it all, and you don't. You don't know it until you're at least 35.
I just think you put too much of yourself into other people sometimes. Whatever I can do to make you happy.
And you end up compromising a lot to please the other person when you could have been spending that on yourself, developing your own interest.
It played havoc on my life for a long time until I got it all figured out.
Well, after 20 years, I split up.
You only get that short amount of time in life to have as much fun as you possibly can.
Have fun first. Enjoy your life. Then get married at 40.
For WYSO, this is Renee Wild and your community voice.
I'm still married, though, to the same guy.
Here's another vox pop, this one from Lauren Schaus, who, despite the advice we just heard, got married during our training course. She's also a working mom.
It's not always easy to get stuff done when you've got a needy little human attached to you. When I wanted to get out and do an interview for radio, I had to drag my 2-year-old along. So I decided to do what parents do best, multitask. I took my kid and my microphone down to the John Bryan Community Center in Yellow Springs for the 3rd annual baby and toddler party, where I asked parents,
what would you do if you had a guilt-free week away from your children?
Oh my gosh. Sleep.
Record as much music as possible.
Go to Hawaii.
Go to lots of dance parties.
Space camp.
How about a vegetarian safari? Well, we could go and watch where they grow exotic vegetables.
You're watching the vegetables grow? That's literally the most boring thing ever. What do you hate about having a kid?
The lack of time to yourself.
The not being able to go to the bathroom by yourself.
Lack of sleep. The not sleeping.
I don't feel like I've felt well-rested since she's been born.
She screams.
I hate the messes.
The drool stain on my left shoulder.
Everything I do at home is with them in mind, and they cry anyway.
It was nice to commiserate, but by the end of the party, all the parents were gathered by the snack table, realizing that we'd already chosen our dream and, well, we were looking at it. Oh, and for the record, what I hate most, it's when my kid interrupts my interview.
Right? I don't know. All that sort of stuff. Yes.
Hey, how you doing? You're ruining my interview.
Yes.
You heard Erica, Caleb, Jackie, Levi, Zoe, Anthony, Steve, Sarah, David, Anne, Rose, little Lucy, and a bunch of kids in a gym. For WYSO's Community Voices, I'm Lauren Shallows.
After practicing their recording and editing skills with the Vox Pop assignment, our trainees develop and produce feature stories, pieces that combine recorded interviews, written narration, and sound that brings the listener to the scene. Kijin Higashibaba takes us to a local Head Start classroom to find out how the federal budget cuts known as sequestration will affect Head Start programs in the Miami Valley. Head Start is an early childhood education program that serves low-income and at-risk families. The across-the-board budget cuts that went into place last March are forcing these programs to cut their budget by over 5%.
I'm with caseworker Amy Hawley in a Head Start classroom in Fairborn. She's talking with a little girl who's painting with a teacher and a classmate.
What did you do?
I mixed the colors gray.
You did? What did you use? What colors did you use?
Black and white.
And it made gray? That's amazing. Yeah. And you did it yourself?
Uh-huh.
Head Start programs are federally funded and free to eligible families. They focus on kindergarten readiness, but also support families in other ways. Children that go to Head Start receive mental and health screenings, and there are programs for parents to help them with their child's development and learning.
We have 17 children in a classroom. We have two teachers in a classroom. We have AM sessions and PM sessions. This is choice time right now, or is this small group time, Miss Judy?
Small group happens during choice time.
So okay.
When it comes time to go to kindergarten, children who haven't gone to preschool have a much harder time keeping up with their peers who have. Low-income families often can't afford to send their children to preschool, so programs like Head Start are especially important. Children with a Head Start background are much more likely to be successful in kindergarten and beyond. Holly has worked in Head Start for 20 years. In that time, she has seen what a difference the program makes in families' lives.
I love what I do, and I do have a passion for it, and the people who work here do as well. I would hate to see cuts come because we do impact. I'm sorry, I do get a little. We do impact a lot of families, and I would hate to see anyone get left behind.
But some may get left behind. All over the country, Head Start programs are closing classrooms. In Ohio, there will be 2,000 fewer spaces for children in the programs, and 300 people are losing their jobs. Still more are taking furlough days. This Head Start Center in Fairborn is run by Council on Rural Services, which is laying off about 30 staff and lowering enrollment by about 160. This has many parents worried. Kim Drake's son is a student here, and she's getting ready to put her daughter in the program in the fall. I asked her what her first reaction was when she heard that the sequester was going to affect Head Start programs.
I was really scared because my daughter's getting ready to start here next year, next school season, and, you know, I have to think about that. You know, what am I going to do with her? And it's just going to be hard for everyone.
Drake put her first child in Head Start so she could look for a job. Since then, she discovered that Head Start is much more than simple childcare. Head Start staff diagnosed her younger son's ADHD and supported her while she learned how to care for him. Her older son is an honor student at his middle school, and she's sure it's because he went to Head Start. The sequester is permanent, but that doesn't mean that funding for Head Start won't be restored in the future. There are proposals at both federal and state levels to add funding for early childhood education to their budgets. These may or may not help Head Start directly. Peggy Lehner is a Republican state senator from Kettering who's working on getting funds added to the state budget for early childhood education. Even though this cut is the largest that Head Start has experienced, Lehner is sure that the lost funding will be restored to Head Start eventually.
Nothing in the funding world is ever permanent when it comes to Washington. Will this money come back? Not, you know, for these 2,000 kids, but hopefully the funding to Head Start will be restored in the months or certainly at least, at the very least, in the years ahead. I don't think anyone believes that this is a permanent loss of funding that will never be restored.
Even with proposals in the works, the cuts had to be made without the expectation of the funding gap being filled in the future. Shirley Hathaway is the executive director of Council on Rural Services that provides Head Start to Greene County. She knows every community has been challenged by the recent economic difficulties, and cuts had to be made. But this cut seems especially harsh. It's not just because it's a large cut, but because it will hit the most vulnerable families the hardest.
So anything that hurts the economy affects our families even bigger. I understand on both sides of the fence that we have to do something, but you always look at where you're putting the most hurt. And families and children that can't do a whole lot to help themselves out of their circumstance, if their children educationally are not going to do as well in school, then we're not helping our nation across the board to have well-educated adults.
For those who are eligible for Head Start in the next couple of years, the impact of the sequester will never be reversed. But the possibility of added funds at both the state and federal levels mean that Head Start and early childhood education could get a boost in the future. For WISO's Community Voices, I'm Kijin Higashibaba.
Kijin took our training course as part of a year-long fellowship at WISO. She'll start her second year at Antioch College this fall. A college degree is viewed as one way to gain access to a decent standard of living. And to pay for it, most students and families will turn to student loans and the financial aid office of the college they attend. A field that few aspire to, but many find rewarding, the director of financial aid plays a crucial institutional role. But who are the people that do this work? Where do they come from? WISO Community Voices producer Seth Gordon has one person's story.
I first met Larry Brickman as a student leader 13 years ago when he interviewed for the financial aid director position at Antioch College. He wore cowboy boots to the interview, and I liked him right away. The world of financial aid is one filled with formulas and acronyms. Spend an hour with someone in the field, and it's difficult to see what would draw someone in.
EFC is the estimated family contribution.
Okay.
Which basically says, based on the information that your family has put together on this FAFSA.
Larry has always enjoyed the minutiae associated with his field. That was the other thing I remember about his interview, that he liked to read federal regulations, something that seemed unfathomable to me at the time. Who likes to read regulations? As college has increased in price, so has the pressure on the director of financial aid, who sits at the nexus of three equally demanding entities, the Fed, the college, and the student. And the director has to balance the needs of all three equally. But Larry's professional life did not begin with financial aid. It began with dance.
I loved the applause. I just loved the feeling of getting the applause, getting the attention of an audience. And that was just really enthralled. I was enthralled by it. I really like dancing, and it's just really high energy and just makes me feel really, really free.
It was the early 80s, and Larry's passion had turned into a serious career path. He began teaching and finding small parts on stage and in local shows in Los Angeles and in another new medium.
Video was just coming into play, and so one of the videos that happened, it was either Chorus Line was auditioning or Thriller. So we auditioned and went through three, four different callbacks. I was very, very lucky. And my professional training was only about maybe 4 years straight. There were 20 of us. There were 10 guys and 10 girls. We rehearsed and danced for 3 or 4 weeks. day and night. Got paid $500, $500 for the entire shoot. And that was a lot.
You're featured pretty prominently. You're not in the back. You were in the front.
I was in behind Michael.
Yeah. And
which
so
was kind of the good thing about being short was being short.
Right.
You know, the one thing I always lucked out, and whenever I did a show, I was always in front because of my height. Thriller costumes were fabulous. They were fitted to the T. It was hot, but it was so much fun. Michael's rehearsing with the whole time. He works with us very closely. He worked with his dancers. He ate with us. He was just an incredible human being. He was so nice and so sweet and so down to earth and cares about the people he works with.
Would you say that's the climax of your dance career or what?
Yeah, I would. And I turned in to be three videos.
Which were what?
They were the Thriller video, White Wedding, and All Night Long with Lionel Richie.
After a decade as a dancer, changes in the industry and Larry's health contributed to his need to find a new way to support himself.
I came into the business as a receptionist at a school in Los Angeles, and I was a temp through a temp agency, and they wanted to hire me a full-time, and I said not as a receptionist. So they said, well, we have a financial aid counselor position open, and I said, what's that?
30 days later, the director quit, and Larry was offered the job. His new school invested in training him, and he grew professionally, moving from college to college, always as the director of financial aid. Still, from Thriller to financial aid, I had to know what the connection was. How did that decade of experience as a dancer help you?
With financial aid?
Yeah.
I can tell you that very easily. Retention. When I would learn dance numbers, dance songs, learn lines for my little bit lines that I have in shows, I have to remember a lot of regulations and a lot of changes that go on in financial aid, not only on a daily or annual basis, but on a monthly basis, et cetera. When I was younger, I could read regulations and retain them very, very easily, just like I did dance. But financial aid, it's you go into it and you're, wham, you're in it. And you better know it and you better learn it quickly because as fast as you learn it, it changes. I love the attention. I love when everybody is on me. It's all about me. I get that high. It's a natural high for me. And when I'm good at what I do, I like to show that and like to share that. I've met a lot of people with a lot of different creative backgrounds. Some are artists, some are singers, musicians, actors, painters.
So
it's very interesting. I'm not unusual in that aspect. But I find that a lot of people that have artist histories seem to be the best financial aid people because they're compassionate, they're considerate, they're warm, they have a good sense of humor, and you have to be a little crazy to like financial aid. My appreciation is what I get back from dance when people are applauding and laughing and saying, you know, I just thoroughly enjoyed you or you made me cry. In financial aid, it's like you made a difference in my life. You were there, you listened. And it's the same thing in dance and in acting. You have to listen. You have to hear. You have to hear the music. You have to hear the steps. You have to see the steps. But you have to hear the steps. So with every beat of the drum, every beat of the violin, or whatever the case may be, you have to picture that step in your mind. And then you have to think ahead of yourself. And it's the same thing with financial aid. You have to think, what's the future? I have to believe in what I'm doing. I have to believe in the school. And I think a lot of financial aid people in this business believe in what they do for students.
Larry is currently making a difference working as the in-house financial aid expert for a new startup software company. He is working to assist financial aid offices with growing federal reporting requirements. For WYSO Community Voices, this is Seth Gordon.
You feel the cold and wonder.
You're listening to part one of WYSO's 2013 Community Voices Special. Radio stories by, for, and about the Miami Valley, produced in this year's training course. We get a lot of bad environmental news these days, so for a change, here's some good news about nature. In the last few years, wildlife have boomed in parklands and green spaces in southwestern Ohio, and some of the critters we're talking about might surprise you. WYSO Community Voices producer Ron Rollins visits the Five Rivers Metro Parks to learn more.
I love the outdoors, and I've seen how wildlife have gradually returned to the Miami Valley. Last winter, I saw something that absolutely stunned me, a bald eagle in downtown Dayton. See, I was on Veterans Parkway along the Great Miami River, and there he was, up in a tree, bold as brass, white head gleaming. Now, I still remember reading Rachel Carson's Silent Spring as a teenager and being sad about the disappearing eagles. I had to learn more about this guy. I called Five Rivers Metro Parks, and I got their spokeswoman at the time, Beth Miller, on the phone, and I told her what I'd seen. She just laughed. "Ron, the eagles are old news around here," she said. "We've got a bear. A bear. Right here in Montgomery County, Ohio."
Bears are quite lazy, and so they like to walk on trails just as much as people do. So after a rain like this, when the ground is really soft, is an excellent time to look for bear tracks.
So I'm hiking with Mike Enright, the conservation biologist for Five Rivers. His job is to monitor and protect all the wildlife in the system's 16,000 acres. On a rainy morning last spring, we struck out on the bear's turf. We're going on a bear hunt. We're looking for bear. It kind of is like Bigfoot sightings, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's why when we get a sighting, we always go out and check, because, you know, it could be somebody's dog, but, you know, we want to make sure that it really is a sighting, and we also want to, you know, kind of gather some information around it to make sure he's not displaying any behaviors he shouldn't be. So a single bear in 6,000 acres has a lot of room to hide, and people don't see him regularly, so obviously he knows what he's doing in avoiding people.
That's going to be his game plan, right?
Yes. Yeah. He hasn't shown any signs of being interested in human garbage or interacting with people, so that's a good sign for him and for us. If you see logs flipped over that are kind of scratched up, that's the bear looking for grubs. And they'll roll over logs that weigh 200-300 pounds, so that's obviously a bear, not kids playing around in the woods. And my favorite is bears leave very big piles of poop around that that don't look like anything else. So
if someone does actually encounter Mr. Bear as they're hiking around, what should they do?
Well, just be calm. Obviously, don't yell and scream at him, and just stop and let him go on his way. He'll if he hasn't seen them, he'll probably just keep doing whatever he's doing and move off onto the woods.
So, okay, you probably won't see Mr. Bear. Doesn't matter how hard you look. But I learned he's really just the furry tip of a very large wildlife iceberg around here. Five Rivers is full of coyotes, beaver, foxes, all kinds of owls, wild turkeys, at least 3 nesting pairs of bald eagles, and so many deer that they have to be controlled by bow hunting, or else they destroyed the forest for all the other animals. Turns out, there's even some big cats.
We had our first bobcat here in the Twin Valley in 2003, and it's a fun story how we realized it was here. One of my coworkers was working late one evening and heard what she thought was a woman yelling at the top of her lungs out in the park. And so she came in and explained this to me, and I said, you know, it's February, that's not a woman yelling, that's a bobcat mating call. And so we've started doing investigations, and since then the neighbors have reported seeing them, and we've also captured them on remote camera. So
have cougars, mountain lions come back into Ohio?
The jury is still out on that. I occasionally get reports of mountain lions, but they usually turn out to be yellow labs. But we still go out and investigate, because both South Dakota and Northern Michigan have populations, so it's theoretically possible that they could migrate through.
That's a long trip from South Dakota.
It is, but they're showing up regularly in Illinois, so we're just a stone's throw away from there.
Wow, cougars. So how did this happen? Well, it's a combination of things. Species are protected now. Park systems like Five Rivers have added more green space and habitat over the years. Streams are clean enough now for restocking of fish that had disappeared. And the animals themselves have learned how to share space with us. Ann Wright says that's okay, that the return of wildlife is really something we should all feel pretty good about.
It is. It's been a great success. You know, the conservation of wildlife specifically in North America has been a huge success. You know, the population's kind of tanked in the late 1800s, early 1900s, but because people recognized that without action, wildlife would disappear, a lot of people took steps to preserve it, let it increase, you know, regulate taking of wildlife. And so really now we're reaping the effects of those things that were done earlier this century with the wildlife coming back. And the big thing is it provides a personal connection to nature. When people see a turkey or a deer or a bear, you know, that's something that stays with them. People really enjoy that wildness in metro parks, and that's a big reason why I think the community has been so supportive of us, because they can come see things like that.
The bear could actually have moved on a long time before you realized it, as rarely as you see him, right?
He could, and like I said, eventually we expect him to probably move back, you know, down south, looking for a female bear at some point in time. So we're happy he's here, but we understand it's probably not going to be permanent.
That's kind of too bad. We didn't find the bear.
We didn't find the bear, but it's looking for a very small needle in a very big 6,000-acre haystack. So
I still think we got to come up with a name for him. Bob Boo Boo. I like that. Yogi. Why not? Hey. For WYSO's Community Voices Project, this is Ron Rollins.
To a different kind of park now. Hidden in a quiet neighborhood in Springfield, Ohio, there's a folk art gem called the Hartman Rock Garden, named after its creator and local resident, Ben Hartman. Hartman was a rock hound, a person who collects rocks. And he would use the rocks he gathered from the area to make concrete and stone replicas of historic buildings. He built so many of these structures that eventually he transformed his entire backyard into a fantastic landscape of miniature buildings and figurines. Renee Wild brings you the story of how Ben Hartman turned his obsession into a national folk art site.
Hello.
Hello.
Are you all here for the Springfield Museum of Art talk today?
I am.
Fantastic.
About 30 people have gathered in the main room of this modest house, waiting for a tour of the Hartman Rock Garden, being led by Mark Chepp, a local folk art collector.
Okay, I'm sort of going to pick and choose here out of the guide, and you can follow along. This is where it all began. This is the beginning of the hobby going wild, as I said. Ben was a pacifist, and as you go through the garden and start getting involved in looking at it, you see basically social commentary that comes through in a number of the objects.
It was the Great Depression. Ben Hartman, like many others, had lost his job. He began looking for a project to occupy his time, and that's when he started collecting rocks. After 8 years and a lot of coffee, his backyard became a shrine that expressed his personal views on family, religion, and patriotism. The centerpiece of the rock garden is the Tree of Life, which is a common folk art form.
It's a cactus, basically. The center stalk of the cactus is the patriotism, the history, and then the two arms, again, repeating the theme we saw over there, school and church on each of the arms, the linchpins of American society as Ben saw them, and then two doves of peace on the one arm coming out by the church.
Ben harvested the materials for his creations from the stream that ran behind his property, rubbish piles, and donations from friends and visitors. He was also known to send his kids out with buckets after the streets had been freshly graveled to collect the rocks off the road.
We don't know how many stones or rock were used to build this. Ben always said about 20,000 to build a Tree of Life, so we start adding these all up. There were a lot of rocks.
When Ben passed away in 1944, his wife Mary took over caring for the rock garden. Their son, Ben Jr., eventually inherited the home, but not his father's passion, and the buildings fell into decay. After Ben Jr. died, the house and gardens went up for auction for $56,000. Let that sink in for a minute. For the price of a low-end luxury car, you could have bought a national folk art site. In an attempt to save her grandfather's legacy, Denise Hartman Kennedy, Ben Jr.'s daughter, contacted the Wisconsin-based Kohler Foundation. It's an art organization that's dedicated to preserving folk art sites. Yep, the Fawcett people are art conservationists, and they're pretty good at it, too. To the Kohler Foundation, Hartman's creations are more than just a roadside attraction. As Terry Yoho, executive director of the Kohler Foundation, explains.
In the art world, they're becoming more and more greatly appreciated and being recognized as not outsider art, but art environments that have been built through the passion of these men and women.
Restoring the Hartman Rock Garden was a lot of work. Every single piece needed repair, and some pieces were missing entirely. The Kohler Foundation provided both the professional expertise as well as the hundreds of thousands of dollars needed to restore the site. But the most important element in the restoration process is finding somebody to maintain the work.
We're really good at finding wonderful art. It's putting together the ultimate recipient, the caretaker for into the future, that really is difficult for us to do.
The relationship between the Kohler Foundation and the local community had some tension in the beginning. Ben's garden is a local landmark and a source of community pride.
At first, people are very wary of us because they feel such a strong ownership in what's there. Second and third generation people living in that same neighborhood, so they grew up with the Hartman Rock Garden.
The Kohler Foundation sent two art conservators to Springfield to begin the restoration process. Benjamin Kujawa and Shane Winters spent every day at the Rock Garden, cataloging the individual pieces and painstakingly restoring each of Ben's creations, rock by rock. Winters says it's not unusual for Midwesterners to be fiercely loyal to these folk art sites.
They didn't like us at first because they thought we were going to cut it apart and take it off somewhere. And people were kind of angry when they first came out, and they had to reassure people, no, 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 it's staying in the community. We're not stealing this treasure.
And they were very supportive once they found out that we were restoring it.
People would drop by, bring us food or pictures, or we have videotapes of people going through the garden.
The Hartman Rock Garden relies on volunteers to landscape the garden and maintain the site. The organization gets by on as little as $10,000 a year to manage the house and gardens. So far, they've been able to keep up with the maintenance of the artwork and the occasional vandalism. Back at the Springfield Art Museum tour, I met husband and wife Barbara and Tony Pellers. I asked them how they knew about the Rock Garden.
It was early 90s that he brought me over because I'd never been here. I moved here when I was 8, and he asked me if I'd ever seen it. And I'm like, no, I've never even heard of it. And he said, well, we're going to go see it, and he brought me over.
Everybody that finds it, you know, they just love the place and comment.
For us, this is our piece of hometown that we wanted everybody else to experience, so they're getting to, so that makes us happy.
For WYSO Community Voices, I'm Renee Wild. Rock on!
For more information on the Hartman Rock Garden, you can find them on Facebook, and you can see more examples of the Kohler Foundation's conservation work at kohlerfoundation.org. Our next story comes from David Seitz, who reports on and sings with the World House Choir. The choir performed its debut concert to celebrate the birthday of Coretta Scott King. Like Mrs. King did all her life, this new community choir sings to promote peace, social justice, and diversity.
Kathy Roma, director of the World House, warms up the choir with a song that not only exercises the choir's vocal cords, but reminds them of their social purpose.
It's like we keep waiting for somebody to come along to get us all together. And my idea is that we are enough, and through our collective work together can make change and not wait for some one person to come along and say, oh, let's do this.
For 30 years, Kathy Roma directed Muse, a women's choir in Cincinnati that sings for peace and social justice. Roma named the World House Choir after one of Dr. Martin Luther King's final essays. In his essay, King compares our modern world to a house that we all have inherited and must live in together if we are to survive.
And I thought, wow, you know, the World House Choir, aren't we all supposed to be on this planet getting along, and how do we do that? And how do we affect change by our singing?
Derek Weston co-founded the choir with Roma. Weston is the director of the Coretta Scott King Center at Antioch College. While Roma was first inspired by Dr. King, Reverend Weston sought to revive the activist work of his wife, Mrs. King, who spoke out for other social issues long after Dr. King's death. Reverend Weston notes that Coretta Scott King was an amazing soprano and trained musician whose singing inspired freedom marchers.
That's something that music can do that an essay can't. That's something that music can do that even the most coherent logical proof can't compel people to move and get out of their seats the way that music can.
Weston and Roma believe this kind of musical energy will raise awareness for issues of social justice within Ohio and beyond. So it's not just what the choir sings, but where they sing and with whom. Roma wants to reach those who do not come to concerts in halls or churches.
Also, what happens if we go to Dayton and we sing in the street? Or what happens if we go to Warren Correctional? Or to Madison Correctional.
Roma wants the World House Choir to sing with prison inmates to call attention to those who are most forgotten. But she also believes this activism begins with nurturing the diversity of a singing community who learn from each other's differences.
Maybe if everybody could say, I feel better when there are Muslim people or Jewish people or African-American people or, you know, that there's a young people, high school and people in college. It feels like a better community when we have these people singing together.
Cheryl Levine, a Jewish member of the World House Choir, connects this diversity to the Jewish concept of tikkun olam, the commandment to help others make the world whole. Levine had never joined a community chorus before because the usual repertoire of Christian songs feels alienating to her.
Instead of feeling part of a community, I feel separate. I'm like, wow, I'm singing about Christ on the cross, and this is so not me. And so you just sort of silently sing these words, and you're thinking, wow, you know, I'm really I'm a Jewish girl here.
But the World House Choir is different. Cheryl believes that this choir will welcome these religious differences rather than assume everyone feels the same about the lyrics. As a tribute to Mrs. King, Kathy Roma chose a repertoire of mostly spirituals and gospel-style songs for this debut concert. Cheryl Levine describes her experience during rehearsals.
It's a strange thing to be talking and singing about Jesus, you know, as a Jewish woman. It feels strange in my mouth, but we must remember that under that strangeness are so many universal truths and desires. So I know when I'm singing about Jesus in this choir, I'm singing a prayer for hope and for faith and for love and for peace, and I guess that's okay with me.
Fortunately, both Reverend Weston and Kathy Roma also recognize the need for a multicultural repertoire as the choir grows. Again, Reverend Weston.
I want the repertoire of the choir to speak to the spiritual longings that come from all of our faith traditions and from those who have no faith tradition, but who are still longing for purpose and meaning and who do have awareness of soul and spirit. I also feel like there are songs of struggle that come from more than just the spirituals. Immigrant communities in this country have their own songs of struggle.
There are words.
Our With the opening song of the Coretta Scott King concert, Kathy Roma encouraged an inclusion of the whole audience within the World House. Reverend Weston.
It was almost like an invitation to dialogue. I mean, from the very first piece, the barrier between this is a choir and this is an audience came down. And we were all kind of in this, on this journey together. It was a really spiritual moment. Gave you this feeling that we're about to experience something really unique together.
Near the end of the concert, Reverend Weston spoke of how Coretta Scott King had to find her own voice after her husband's death. He compared Mrs. King's experience to the mission he hoped for the World House Choir.
All of this tonight has been about us finding a voice for those who don't have a voice. The next group of people that will hear this choir perform will be a group of prison inmates because they need to have their voices heard. In a system that has been developed to treat people like numbers, in a system that has been developed to dehumanize people, they need a voice. And we're going to give them a voice and be a voice along with them.
There's lots of work to be done, so eloquently spoken by Derek Weston. Now, there's one more job, and that is one more song to sing.
How do we get the nerve to meet somebody that's different? Maybe we go sing and we join issues and ideas that are important to that group of people and join with them, and then it gets bigger and bigger. We don't want to just come together to sing. That's not the purpose. It's to be in each other's lives and sing.
For WYSO Community Voices, this is David Seitz.
Since their debut concert, the World House Choir visited Madison Correctional Prison to sing with Ubuntu, a male inmate choir directed by Kathy Roma. And in the fall, the World House Choir will perform for a 9/11 memorial and the UN International Day of Peace. We close this hour with a story from Lauren Schaus, who, by the way, had this story in mind long before a certain episode of This American Life came out. Her piece centers around sounds like crinkling paper, nails tapping on a table, a soft voice. For most of us, these sounds aren't much more than your average background noise, but for some, sounds like these trigger a physiological phenomenon known as autonomous sensory meridian response, or ASMR. Lauren's story begins with one of these triggers.
Hello, dear friends. Good evening. So, this little spoon, are you interested in the spoon?
The voice you're hearing belongs to a woman named Yang Haiying. In this YouTube video, she's filming a metal spoon with a Mickey Mouse-like character stamped on it. She turns it over in her hands, delicately, and explains how she found it at her mother's home in Beijing.
So where did I get it? It's buried in chicken powder, actually, chicken flavoring, to make soup, chicken stir fry. This one is sold together with chicken powder.
Just a second, Haiying. Would you say that one more time?
Chicken powder.
Every time she says those words,
chicken powder,
I get this amazing feeling.
Chicken powder.
This beautiful, warm, delicious blanket of sensation. It starts in the top of my head, spreads down my neck and arms, into the tips of my fingers. Okay, just one more time.
Chicken powder.
The sensation I just described is familiar to anybody who experiences autonomous sensory meridian response. Most folks who get the feeling describe it the same way.
Like a tingling.
It's like a brain tingling in a sense.
A reaction that makes your head and body tingly is very nice.
The sensations ASMR produces are pure pleasure and tend to produce a calming effect. Some who experience it use it to help relax or get to sleep, others to help themselves focus. ASMR can be triggered by any number of sounds, usually soft and repetitive, or by watching someone complete a slow, deliberate task. For most of us, it's best when both are combined. And how many of us are there? According to the internet, which is always accurate, there are thousands. And before we go any further, there is one thing about ASMR that every single one of us would like to make clear to you. It is definitely not sexual.
Welcome home, honey. Why don't you take your jacket off? Just start to relax, okay?
We know how it sounds. We know you're not going to believe us. And that's why you've never heard of ASMR, because we've never told you. Take my sister, Haley, and me. We both have a memory of a summer when we were kids. We spent hours watching the same instructional video together over and over, a woman using modeling clay. We both agreed it made us feel amazing. Then we never talked about it again. Until I called Haley up for this piece. Her experience with discovering the term ASMR, and that she wasn't alone, is a familiar one to me and to a lot of us in the ASMR community. We talked via Skype.
I don't know, it never occurred to me that it might be a thing until all of a sudden I just decided to Google tingly head or whatever I Googled, and that was the first time that I found out it had a name and lots of people experienced it.
The internet is the insatiable playground of any number of obscure appetites, so it was only natural that this is where the ASMR community would make its home. YouTube hosts a bevy of content when it comes to ASMR, created by members of the community. These content producers call themselves whisperers. To those of us who watch them, sometimes on a daily basis, they're essentially celebrities. One of the biggest stars in the ASMR world is Maria, or Gentle Whispering, as she's known on YouTube. Her videos run the gamut of ASMR fare: sound effects videos, whispered readings, and soft-spoken role plays, in which she pretends to be an eye doctor, a skincare expert, or a hairdresser, delicately explaining every step in her process up close.
My name is Maria, and so I'll be your hairstylist today. Now we need you just to lean back. Okay.
As of today, Maria's YouTube channel has more than 90,000 subscribers, and her videos have more than 25 million views, which is why I was totally stoked when she agreed to talk to me about how she got into making ASMR videos.
I've been listening to ASMR videos about a year before I started making my own videos, and I found this community because I was going through some stress and depression times, which actually helped me to recover from a lot of my anxiety.
Despite the thousands of people, including myself, who pine for every new video she produces, Maria says she doesn't think of herself as a celebrity. She makes ASMR videos, she says, because they helped her in a time of need, and she wants to give back.
I get letters from military men who fight nightmares and watch these videos to calm down. Firefighters, doctors, pilots, lawyers, working single moms, teenagers with some kind of anxiety problems. And all of them are just so sincere and so full of gratitude. You just can't help but get to the camera and make something good for them.
So, what causes ASMR? As yet, there's really no answer. Science generally seems preoccupied with issues that don't involve people getting tingly in front of their computers. Even the term ASMR was made up by someone to replace the previous, less legitimate-sounding term for the phenomenon, brain orgasm. Again, not sexual. But the fact that nobody knows what causes ASMR means we're less likely to tell our friends and family about it, since we can't explain it. It was only after I put out a query on Facebook that I found out I had two friends, Jeff and JD, who also experience ASMR. I asked Jeff what the people in his life think about it.
Oh, it's something that I honestly haven't really been public about until this interview.
JD also said he'd never mentioned it to anyone in his daily, non-internet life. Or, for that matter, his internet life.
It's really weird to hear ASMR community. It feels inherently private.
My sister Haley said she only recently told her husband about her predilection for late-night whisper indulgence.
I think he even came in to the living room where I was on the computer, got up out of bed and said, "That's really creeping me out. Could you turn that down?" And then at that point, I told him, "Hey, I'm not a creep. This is, you know, something that relaxes me and gives me this tingly feeling." If you were to come into somebody watching that, just walk into a room and, you know, you have to explain yourself, "Oh, this makes me tingly," you know, like.
I asked Haley's husband, Ian, what he knew about ASMR.
Well, I think it's supposed to give you, like, some kind of sensation when you listen to it, kind of like that feeling in your head. Is that kind of right?
So it's not weird to you?
No.
Because Haley said you said it was weird.
No. I don't remember that.
Oh my God.
My own husband, Anthony, has no qualms with sharing his opinion on the whole thing.
Atypical. Not usual.
Okay, fair enough.
But there is hope on the horizon for us. A study on ASMR is underway now at Dartmouth College. A student associated with the study posted a query for test subjects on the social entertainment site Reddit several months ago. Posting under the handle BlockD, the student had this to say. Since these videos trigger a powerful response in people, for better or for worse, I was interested in seeing what regions of the brain they're activating. I got in touch with BlockD via email, who said he'll be wrapping up his data analysis later this summer, but can't say much about his findings just yet. Until then, all of us who experience ASMR will continue to commune, faceless, on the internet. We've got our headphones on, listening and waiting.
I can't be myself.
The flute.
For WYSO's Community Voices, I'm Lauren Schaus.
This hour, we've heard some of the stories produced in WYSO's training course. Tune in next week for part two of the 2013 Community Voices special. We'll hear the story of how the Dayton Dragons came to be, meet the leaders of the polyamory community in the Dayton area, explore the meaning of cultural heritage, and more. That's at 7 p.m. next Sunday, August 18th, on part two of the WYSO 2013 Community Voices special.